All right. Good morning, everybody. My name is Edward Birch. I work with David Michael out in San Francisco. I know many of you know David Michael from these conferences. In fact, I started working with David Michael back in 2007, and David had already sort of made a name for himself being a specialist in forfeiture law. And since 2007, I think that we've focused even more on forfeiture defense, and in particular, civil asset forfeiture defense. And just so that I don't take it for granted that everybody knows what forfeiture is, federal and state statutes allow the government to seize and condemn money if the government can prove that it's connected to some crime. And the most frequent one, that in my opinion, is of course drug trafficking. And I'm going to be kind of ambitious and try to cover a lot. And so I want to start off with a short video, and it's not going to be immediately clear why I'm showing it, but it should be after the first 30 seconds or the first scene. So I'm just going to get right to it. All right, so that's that. I'm showing the video because I think that anybody who's defended your typical civil forfeiture action knows that that's about the quantity and quality of evidence the government often proceeds with. And there's a caveat, but when I say typical civil forfeiture action, it's a typical interdiction stop where, you know, the client is stopped at the airport or a train station, and they do an interview, and one thing leads to another, then some money gets seized, and all of a sudden you're in court trying to get your money back. So what else should I say about this? So I have here underlined, this is the basic outline. I want to spend about half my time on issues like the standing and the special interrogatories, and and some other considerations, and then the other half on dog alerts to currency. And I have judicial underlined there because, like I said, I want to cover a lot, and I'm not going to get into administrative forfeiture at all. I'm going to go from the point of the filing of the judicial complaint forward. And I'm sure many of you have heard of the David Smith Treatise, Prosecution and Defense of Forfeiture Cases. But if you need a good resource for administrative forfeiture issues, that's the one to go to. And let's see. So the caveat to the quantity and quality of evidence, of course, is the dog alerts of currency. And that's why I want to spend a lot of time on that. But I want to get started right away with Article 3 standing, compliance with Rule G and the Rule G special interrogatories. And the compliance with Rule G has been called statutory standing by the government, and they've really made a mess, caused a lot of havoc by calling it statutory standing. So a theme that I'm going to keep pounding on throughout this talk is that Article 3 standing is very different from compliance with Rule G standing, and there is no such thing as statutory standing. And hopefully it'll become clearer as I move forward, but the reason I want to spend a lot of time on standing and compliance with Rule G is because at Key West last year, I was introduced as a forfeiture attorney. And the first thing that the other attorney I was introduced to told me was, oh, wow, yeah, but it's an uphill battle because you got to answer those special interrogatories. And so, I get this sense a lot that defense attorneys don't like to come into a case and immediately have to submit their client to a bunch of under oath questions and responses from the government. So that's why I want to spend a lot of time on that. I'm hoping as I go through it, we'll actually see that we've won some good battles on that. The forfeiture defense bar has won some good battles, and it's not such an intimidating thing. And so maybe some of you that haven't done civil forfeiture will feel a little bit more emboldened to do it. So the initial background that you have to know on this is this statute, 18 U.S.C. 983C, is part of CAFRA, the Civil Asset Reform Act of 2000. And this was considered a really big sea change in forfeiture law because prior to this statute, the government merely had to prove probable cause to connect any property to a crime. And this statute obviously flipped that burden so that the government now has to prove by a preponderance of evidence that the property is subject to forfeiture. And so they've got to prove that whatever seized property they got was connected to a crime. And let's see, that's about that. So that's the basic background you need. And then we're getting into Article 3 standing. So everybody knows Article 3 standing is just this constitutional concept. It's a case or controversy concept. And it's all it says is, are the courts deciding real issues versus hypothetical issues, and are the correct, and the, is the court deciding whatever controversy between the correct parties? So it's pretty simple, but like I said, the government really tried to make a mess of this whole thing by calling compliance with Rule G statutory standing. And Rule G, as we had CAFRA in 2000, that kind of lays out the general burdens and some other notice procedures, but we had Rule G come along in 2006. And it got incorporated into the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, and it was supposed to ostensibly clarify some of the procedural things that were coming up in forfeiture cases. But in fact, it's just really made a mess of things, and I certainly blame the government for that. I want to just really emphasize that I think we really need to keep clear Article 3 standing is standing, and compliance with Rule G is compliance with the statute, and it shouldn't be called statutory standing ever. So this was our case in the Seventh Circuit, and we'll get into what was going on in this case, but I want to start with it because they're basically saying what I really want to emphasize throughout this talk, and that's the Supreme Court recently clarified and narrowed standing doctrine, reminded us that federal courts have a virtually unflagging obligation to decide cases within their Article III jurisdiction. And the court also cautioned that labels like statutory standing are misleading and should be avoided. So again, what they're saying is Article III standing is standing, and statutory standing doesn't exist. Article III standing or compliance with the statute. So this is why I'm going to get into why this is really important, but here's how the government was really giving forfeiture attorneys a headache. Rule G says that they can try to strike you right away for failing to comply with Rule G5, which is the pleading requirements, what needs to go in your claim, or because you don't have standing. And so those are two different concepts, but the government was really trying to blur those concepts, and in my opinion, was kind of confusing a lot of district court judges. And I have this, and you can even see in that section of Rule G that the statute itself is telling you that it's two different concepts. And I have this C also because this says the sufficiency of the complaint is governed by Rule G2. So that's compliance with the statute. And nobody's going to come in and say that if the government didn't have their complaint follow Rule G2, that the government doesn't have standing. It just doesn't really make sense. But that's exactly what the government did to claimants. They said if you're not complying with the different things in Rule G5, then you don't have standing. And that's just not right. So the first thing, let's get into this challenge to a claimant's pleading. And that's here, Rule G5 again, the pleading. So this was, again, out of the Seventh Circuit. And the government was basically going around and saying, claimants aren't complying with, if you just say, hey, I own the property that you took from me, they're saying that's not enough for your pleading. That's not enough for the very first thing in your claim. And this was Judge Posner. And he laid it out pretty simply because the rule is pretty simple. And he says, you know, all that Rule G5 requires is that it's signed under penalty of perjury. The claimant identify the specific property, identify the claimant, and state the claimant's interest in the property. And that's pretty much it. It should be really simple. But keep in mind that this appellate panel reversed a district court for finding that, as he said, I'll just read it. The judge held that to comply with the rule, the claimant had to state in addition how he obtained possession, including but not limited to the person from whom he received the currency, the date of receipt, the place of receipt, on and on. And so I just sort of like Judge Posner's style, but he says, you know, actually such a bald assertion does comply with the rule. The additional assertions required by the judge have no basis in it. So I love the simplicity, but remember, it was the government was just giving everybody a hard time, and this was a reversal of the district court throwing a claimant out. So this is our judicial claim language that, again, just your typical interdiction where they take some money from the client. This is all that really needs to go in the claim. You put in the caption what property was seized, of course. You sign this, and then you sign your name under penalty of perjury, and that's it. It's really pretty simple. Like I said, there were some battles about it, but I think at this point it should be pretty settled. There's some good case law, and the slide before was a good example. So let's see, moving on. As I said, standing is different from compliance with the statute. And so let me just go back to this again. So again, remember the government can move to strike you out of the case for failing to comply with Rule G5, which is the pleading requirements, or because the claimant lacks standing. So now we're going to talk about this second one. So I think that now it's really established that a simple claim of ownership in your pleading gives you Article 3 standing. And so, and this is a quote from the Tenth Circuit, in cases which a person has asserted an ownership interest, our sister courts have not required the claimant to present the type of explanatory evidence urged by the government to establish his or her standing. And so in the written materials, I have cites and quotes from published opinions in every single circuit in the country, except for, couldn't find one from the third. But my favorite is this one. And again, Seventh Circuit, Judge Posner. This was our case, and it was actually a companion case to the earlier one I read. But the facts were basically an informant had sort of ratted out our guy. They put a GPS on his car. Followed him around to a storage space, and they found a bunch of pot and money in the storage space. So they took the money, and you know, the rest is history. But I'll just read this because I like the sarcasm. at the pleading stage, Article 3 standing is something to be alleged, not proved, and all that must be alleged is an injury personal to the person seeking judicial relief that the court can redress, such as the injury inflicted by the government when it has got hold of money that belongs to the person and refuses to return it. This is Constitutional Law 101. And so I particularly love this because we took a hell of a lot of abuse from the district court before we got this reversal. And so I wanted to just give you guys a little taste of some of the abuse that we took, and I'm going to just read it because it's great. The intransigence of claimants' counsel has been the principal roadblock standing in the way of this court's desire to resolve the Article III standing issue. Claimants' counsel has stubbornly refused to respond to the government's special interrogatories, seeking to justify that refusal in material part by the same arguments that the same California lawyer had advanced and that were found wanting by the Ninth Circuit earlier this year. Patience has its limits. Resolution of the parties impasse is past due. So he threw us out, and then we get this great language from Judge Pazer. So I give that as sort of like, I feel like when I'm on the other side, I read stuff like that, and it's a good kind of morale boost. But it's also a really good segue to the special interrogatories, because that's what he's talking about in our California case. So this was out of Chicago, and so he's dumping on us for being coming in and giving him problems in his district. But let's move on to the special interrogatories. This is part of the advisory committee note to Rule G6, and this is kind of the key to really defend against special interrogatories, because this is what links the special interrogatories to standing, and again, Article 3 standing. And so it says that the subdivision permits the government to file limited interrogatories at any time after the claim is filed to gather information that bears on the claimant's standing. So we really need to know that. And this is the actual language of Rule G6. And this is I'm going to flip right to that, because the government can strike you if you fail to comply with Rule G6. But it also can hang you up and try to delay you on, for instance, a motion to dismiss until after you've responded to the special interrogatory. So obviously they were using this and other parts of Rule G6 to really push claimants around and not let claimants really do anything at the beginning of the case until they could get a bunch of hearings trying to throw you out. But let's survey how the case law developed on this to figure out how we can battle back against it. So the Ninth Circuit initially made a mess of the special interrogatories, and that was the case that Judge Shader in Chicago, I forgot to mention his name, that's what he was talking about when he said we had these failed arguments in the Ninth Circuit. So we're going to talk about that. But the Seventh Circuit and the Eighth Circuit really nailed it on this one. So I'll get to why it's dicta, but let's talk about 133. It was sort of a thorn in our side, and this was our case. It was the first case. I think it was the first Rule G6 case that went up to appeal, and it's a really long, poorly written opinion. But they gave us some good stuff, but they gave us some bad stuff. So the first thing was that they confirmed kind of what we were talking about earlier, that a simple claim of ownership will give you standing. And they even went a little bit further to really solidify the concept that if you claim ownership over something that you possess, then that's going to give you standing not only at the beginning stages, but even if you get to summary judgment and even at trial. So that's really important, as we'll find out, because a bunch of other... Are you guys hearing me okay? Or am I too loud or too quiet? Okay. It's going to be really important, because a lot of the subsequent case law has really pointed to that concept about when they're tightening up this Rule G6 and giving us some better opinions on Rule G6. But what happened was that our claimant had claimed an ownership and or possessory interest in his claim language. So that they said that doesn't confer standing, because if you're saying that you're a possessor, then you got to explain how you got it if you're not the owner. So because Rule G6 allows the government to collect this information regarding the defendant's relationship to the claimant's relationship to the defendant property, and the advisory committee note has this little bit that says, if you assert your interest as a bailee, then the interrogatories can inquire into the bailor's interest in the property and the bailee's relationship to the bailor. So they said that the government in the special interrogatories were entitled to explanatory answers. We just pretty much said, hey, I own it. That's it. I've got standing. We're done. But they said because we had that and or in the claim, they struck our, and we didn't say we're owners until we got to the special interrogatory responses. So they struck our interrogatory responses, and then that allowed them to say that we didn't have standing, and then summary judgment, we get thrown out. So that's 133. And I think as you read this and kind of take it in, I think you can understand probably what's the simple solution is you just don't have that ambiguous language in the claim. But it was definitely a thorn in our side for a couple years because the government was definitely throwing it in our face every chance they get. But we had redemption in the Seventh Circuit. This was a case out of Chicago. I flashed the quote earlier when I was talking about Article 3 standing versus compliance with the statute. But this is how beautifully and simply the Seventh Circuit did. And it's kind of funny because we really made this almost the exact same arguments in both cases, but because we had the clean owner claim language at the bottom of this one, they gave it to us and they gave us a really beautiful opinion that I think is really just kind of required reading just to get to understand burdens and standing and forfeiture. So they say the government argues that the claimants fail to comply with Rule G6. And they tie it to the standing. And so they say, well, claimants objected to the scope of interrogatories, but the claimant asserted under oath and unequivocally that he owns a defendant property and that it was in his possession when it was seized. So these facts are sufficient for a claimant to establish standing at summary judgment. So no more responses are required. So let's move on to the next stage. And it's really simple and it was really beautiful for me. But that's tying it to that. They were actually citing to 133 when they said ownership plus possession is standing at summary judgment. So even though 133 was kind of a thorn in our side, and it still helps on a lot of cases, and we'll see another example of that in a second. So let's see. This is how the 239 court, the Seventh Circuit, this is how they got to that. Because basically what the government was saying was that through special interrogatories, you have to prove that the property was what they were calling that your interest was a legitimate ownership. So basically, demonstrating legitimate ownership is tantamount to demonstrating that property is not subject to forfeiture. And anytime the government moves for summary judgment on standing in a civil forfeiture action, then the claimant would have to carry the burden of establishing that his property is not subject to forfeiture. And that would effectively shift the burden of proof from the government back to the claimant, contrary to a central reform in CAFRA. And that central reform was the very first slide I showed where it says that big C change where they said, no, it's the government's burden to prove stuff, to prove the forfeitability, not the claimant's burden to prove not forfeitable. So that was the backbone. And again, I think this is a really great case to read. The Eighth Circuit also has a really good Rule G6 case. And it's in the site is in the written materials, but I want to cover a lot of stuff, so I want to move on. But here's Ninth Circuit kind of tightening themselves up because they say where a claimant's Article 3 standing is not reasonably in dispute, then his failure to respond to Rule G6 special interrogatories does not in itself warrant striking his claim because standing is not contingent on his compliance with Rule G6. So then they finally come around and really tighten it up that Article 3 standing is Article 3 standing. And compliance with Rule G6 is compliance with the statute. That is not standing. There's no such thing as statutory standing. Don't use it. So if you're in the Ninth Circuit or if you're in front of a judge that is just not wanting to understand or you have a really aggressive AUSA on the Rule G6 interrogatories, want to go through some tips to push back against it. Again, as I alluded to earlier, 133... the claimant had left open the possibility that he was just the possessor. So that was what really doomed him. But in your case, as long as you have your guys right from the beginning of the claim saying he's an owner, then he's fine because even all other things aside, even if his interrogatories are stricken, he's still got that claim that gives him standing at the beginning of the case. So here's a subsequent case in the Ninth Circuit that says, look, there's two different standards. There's a standard of proof for a claimant asserting a possessory interest, and then there's a different standard of proof for a claimant saying he's the owner. So that's that, and I'll move on. The second point to push back is that it was dicta. Really, 133 didn't even have to get into Rule G6 because the procedural posture was such that we had already been into mutual discovery. So we were in a much later stage of the case, and in fact, the government had served Rule 33 interrogatories. And of course, those aren't limited in scope. So that's just another little bullet point to push back against 133. And the bottom line is that I would recommend always starting with the minimal response. And the minimal response was what we talked about from 239, which was the claimant asserts that he owns a defendant property and that it was in his possession when it was seized. You start with that, and that, like I said, that gives you standing, and that should really insulate you from claims against the special interrogatories. And it'll be a fight in the Ninth Circuit, but this is a district court case within the Ninth Circuit that we litigated, and the judge felt he was kind of tied, he was bound by 133. So we couldn't convince him that an ownership case is different and it's a different set of rules for Rule G6. But what happened was the government did a bunch of motions to compel and a bunch of motions to strike. And the government, even though we couldn't convince the judge that we were right on the Rule G6, the judge wouldn't kick us out of the case. And so he says, as the advisory committee notes, point out, not every failure to respond warrants order striking the claim. And furthermore, this is not a case in which the claimant has completely failed to respond to special interrogatory. So we started off with that really minimal language. Of course, we objected. And then we just kept leaking a little bit more. And I think it was two or three times where the judge said, that's not quite enough. You got to go back. We weren't kicked out of the case. And in the meantime, we were able to litigate a motion to suppress and get a full evidentiary hearing and do a bunch of other and kind of take charge of the case and feel like we're not being pushed around by the AUSA in that case. It was really aggressive AUSA. So that also, it also drove her crazy. So there's a kind of its own, that's kind of its own benefit sometimes. But anyhow, Rule G6 interrogatories, it's not such an uphill battle, and there's some good case law, and you got to fight the good fight on them. So I'm going to move just to some other pretrial considerations and motions, but not spend a lot of time because I really want to get to the dog alert. So, motion to suppress, you got that. Certainly, a handful of or more of forfeiture cases have been effectively won on a motion to suppress. You got your motion to dismiss. It's in Rule G6, or I'm sorry, Rule G8. And there's a couple examples of a motion to dismiss. There's a 90-day deadline after the claimant files his administrative claim. And that's a really hard, rigid deadline. So if the government misses that one, then they're doomed. There's another kind of soft deadline if they're late on notice. It's not such a tough statute with teeth. It's kind of, claimants haven't had luck with that one. And then we've run this one a couple times where it's a due process delay. There's some case law that says if the government's getting too many motions to stay and they're really kicking the can, then at some point it violates due process. And we haven't had an outright dismissal on that one, but and I haven't seen too many in recent forfeiture cases, if any at all. But sometimes strategically, it can work out to your benefit. Sometimes it'll get the judge pissed off if he feels like the government is really kicking the can too much. So that's that. There's a motion for summary judgment, of course. It's not in Rule G, but you of course have it. And then there is the old statute, which is 19 U.S.C. 1615, which says that the government has to have probable cause right at the beginning of the case to properly file a complaint. So the Ninth Circuit has really established that you can run that motion, and it survives CAFRA. It's not so fleshed out in other appellate circuits, but I think that there's no reason to not always run it in the Ninth Circuit, or even if you're out of the Ninth Circuit, just saying, sure, it survives CAFRA. But and then last thing is, motion for attorney fees. If you win a civil forfeiture case, the government's got to fork over your attorney fees and costs. So here's a couple good examples. And this was, the first one is out of Southern California. It's Eric Honig, a great forfeiture attorney down there. The government did a forfeiture action against 17,000. Eric won it on summary judgment, and the judge awarded him $100,000 in attorney fees. And the second one is our case. We won it on a motion to suppress, $85,000 at stake in Utah. And we had to take it up to appeal to finally win, and then bounce it back down. And the judge gave us $200,000 in attorney fees. And notice at $550 an hour and $625 an hour. So you're going to get paid your your just desserts if you win one of these cases, and government's going to have to pay top dollar. So another reason I just kind of flashed this is because I think sometimes people in their head have, oh, it's like $10,000. Like, is it really worth fighting it? But it really is, because I think that if you really win, you know, you're going to get this great attorney fee award for fighting it. And sometimes frankly, it's easier to win, to convince a judge that that $10,000 is not connected to drug trafficking versus $300,000 in cash. So, yeah. Yeah, exactly. So we argued that since civil forfeiture is a very, very specialized area, that we were entitled to like the national civil forfeiture specialist rate, and the judge agreed with us. He didn't do it as a multiplier. He did it as part of that's the reasonable rate because I think the case law says reasonable rate for the attorney in his practice area. You know, and so of course the government was trying to say, no, you only get the Utah rate, which was half as much or something. But yeah, we were able to convince him that we got, you know, we pointed to the fact that there wasn't any forfeiture specialists in Utah, things like this, and we had lots of declarations and everything, but yeah, we were able to convince him that we got the specialist rate.
Out of curiosity, how much were you asking for?
I think he hacked us about 6,000 or 8,000, not too much. But the government had to really get specific on, they had to show that there was some work that we did that, you know, oh, you didn't spend 7 hours on this. So the government has to really work to show that, as long as you have your sheets, your timesheets, they're going to have to show that something's unreasonable, you know, because it's a pretty mandatory statute. So that was on 85,000. Yeah, and it was a typical traffic stop. And like I said, we won it on a motion to suppress. Yeah, the ultimate fee was 195 plus 2,000 in costs. We were asking for about two something, but they only hacked off about, the judge only hacked off about 8,000, I think. Six. Yeah. Okay, so that's that. I want to move to dog alerts. This is the basic outline of what I want to cover on dog alerts. You challenge them substantively by experts, chemistry or a cueing argument. I should say chemistry and a cueing argument, because you want to do both. And then procedurally by a spoliation argument. And that's the theory that the government, by depositing in the bank, they destroyed material evidence and they prevented you from being able to test it in a lab. So I'll mention that quickly. But here's the typical scenario. Officer A, the interdicting officer, seizes the money and then he calls for a dog team. The officer B is the dog handler and he's immediately told, hey, we got some drug money here. And then he tells A to hide the money. And then Officer A hides the money. Officer B comes with the dog. And then both A and B, you know, stand in there as the dog, you know, alerts. And what a surprise, you know. And I think everybody knows what's going on. But then they use this to say that, oh, this proves it. Money was from drug sales. I'm not sure how they get to sales. But anyhow, the argument, of course, is that the money smelled like drugs. So everybody knows all money's contaminated with drugs and dogs are cued by handlers. So an alert is meaningless. But never rely on hand waving without expert or multiple experts. So here's what I mean. This is an old case out of Ninth Circuit. The expert was actually James Woodford, who spoke at Key West. He's a great expert, but he said that, look, 90% of cash in the U.S. is contaminated with enough cocaine to make a dog alert, and then the government didn't really challenge it. So even though a claimant was all these laundry list of pretty suspicious facts, I suppose, from a United States attorney's eyes, the Ninth Circuit granted summary judgment saying this evidence is, even with a dog alert, it's not even enough for probable cause. So that's a great opinion, but you kind of flash forward. And then the government, to kind of push back against what Woodford was saying, he had these two doctors, Drs. Rose and Furton, and they were, of course, funded by law enforcement. But they did a couple of studies where they basically are trying to rebut Woodford's thing. And they're really convoluted studies, and we're going to talk a little bit later about how to attack them. But they basically did it in two parts. They dripped some synthetic cocaine on a single dollar bill, and they determined that there's a certain amount that a dog could alert to. And then in a separate part, they said, they said that after 2 hours, it dissipates. And then a separate part, they were presenting it to the dog. So anyways, it's kind of a mess, but they said, hey, that means that only if money has been in really recent contact with a large amount of drugs is it going to smell enough for a dog to alert. So they, first Ninth Circuit case, they present this evidence, and the claimant didn't dispute the evidence. You know, he probably made some arguments, but there was no expert called or anything. And so then the Ninth Circuit dumps on him, and they affirm government summary judgment. And then it gets worse, like a domino effect, because then you move forward to the next year, and they're not even introducing the government, the scientists. They're actually, the dog handlers basically just saying what the scientists were saying. And then because it was undisputed, the claimant didn't call any expert witnesses, you get dumped on summary judgment again. And then just one more time, same thing in 2014. Oops. So we're in these cases, we're probably, we're past the pleading, we're past it. In the first one, there wasn't even special interrogatories, but you get to a point where the government says that we have such overwhelming evidence that you don't even get to a trial, and then they move for summary judgment. And you basically have the competing declarations. And so in this first case, you know, the government presents its basic profile evidence, you know, short turnover, all that drug profile stuff. And they say, and we got this dog alert. And so essentially what the Ninth Circuit was said in this case was like, well, this is like, we've got some science that says the dog alert is reliable to connect it to drug sales. And so then the court says, summary judgment for the government. End of story. See you later. Oh, sorry. Like a suspicious travel, like on the drug courier profile. So they're gonna say your guy bought his ticket with cash the day before he traveled. He flew from New York to California and he only stayed there for one day, so that's a short turnaround. Yeah, all that stuff. California is a source state. You know, all this. You know, typical. Yeah. So, let's see, where am I at with this? Yeah, so you get this domino effect of really bad opinions, and then you go to the, and also in the Seventh Circuit, a really bad case where they also said that the dog alerts to currency should be entitled to probative weight in a forfeiture action. And it was a really strange thing that I thought that happened, but they go up on appeal, and it was a pro se claimant, and they said, well, it seems to be there's some dispute about this dog alert, and they ask for all the scientific research on the appellate level, which it, to start with, that's really kind of strange, shouldn't be done. But anyways, the claimant presented one single article, and the article was a pro-law enforcement article that basically the author himself said that dogs were okay for this purpose. And in fact, the author specifically acknowledged the scientific findings of Drs. Rose and Furton. So you get this bad opinion, and then claimants were living with it for a while. But finally, a couple years ago, Steve Comey out of Chicago, who I'm sure many of you know. Oh, only 5 minutes? Oh, shit. Okay. going long. All right. Well, let's see. Anyway, Steve Comey, he introduced experts and he wins. It's a great opinion. Check it out. If anything's not in the materials, you know, email me if you have any questions. But let's see. And then here's our case where we fought the dog on cueing. And so I guess if I have 5 minutes, I don't know how I'm going to get through all this stuff in 5 minutes, but let me see. There's some basic building blocks of what you have to understand to fight the dog alert on cueing. Clever Hans effect. I don't have time to go through it, but Hans is the horse in Germany that was said to be able to answer questions by tapping his hoof. So it's an important concept that you got to start with. You got to educate the judge through experts. They found out ultimately, I'll just do the big bullet point, if If the owners had stepped away, Hans was only correct when the audience heard and knew the answer. So what was basically going on is that the audience was giving subtle physical cues to the dog. So that's that. The researcher couldn't even avoid giving cues to the dog if he tried. Cues to the horse, jumping ahead of myself. So people unconsciously communicate that information to animals, those subtle, minute physical movements and gestures. That's the first building block. The second is that dogs, in fact, are experts at this. And let's see if I can get through this video.
Adam Miklosi works at the Department of Ethology at the Eötvös Loránd University in Budapest. He and his team have devised experiments designed to understand how dogs communicate with people.
People know a lot of things about dog behavior, which is perhaps special to that species or a given breed, but they don't know too much how this behavior relates to the human behavior. So for us, dogs are not a separate species. For us, dogs basically form a mixed group together with humans, and this mixed group is the focus of our attention or our research.
Most dogs seem to have an innate type of intelligence no other animal can claim, imitating humans easily, repeating gestures, following a person's lead. According to Miklosi, imitation is the basis of culture. It's how we pass knowledge down from one generation to another. The dog's imitative knack, just one form of communication, is undeniable. But how well do they communicate with us? And how did that come to be? To discern this, Miklosi turned to the wolf.
I think the reason for looking at wolves is very important because you can really appreciate the difference between the two species. So, to understand dogs, you really have to understand the original species, the ancestor. And this is the reason why we started this project with the wolves.
Any reason to come out, don't worry. We are very nice.
His team raised a pack of wolves and a group of dogs simultaneously, exposing them to the same type of human contact and behavior.
They are living together with people. They interact with them every day, 24 hours a day. And at the end, you get a wolf that behaves in many respects as a dog when he meets a human.
The team then began a series of tests for both dog and wolf. The first experiment tests the animal's response to human gestures. Dogs are perceptive to human body movement, from subtle head and eye signals to larger gestures. Two bowls are scented with meat in order to attract the dog. This dog immediately goes where the human points and doesn't investigate the other dish. It looks to the human for guidance. Even puppies look to people for information, which led Miklosi to suspect they are hardwired for this behavior. And then the wolves are put to the test. The researcher starts with the same pointing experiment. But the wolf is uninterested in what the person is doing. And unlike the dog, the wolf does not look to the human for help, despite the domestication of this pack.
What we have learned from many experiments is that dogs have this ability. They are kind of keen on observing humans, and they have also the ability to use this information if they have to solve a problem.
Next, the team conducts a problem-solving experiment. They place a piece of meat on a rope. The wolf will need to pull on the rope in order to get the reward. This is easily done. Then the dog is put to the same test. Like the wolf, the dog will easily get the meat by pulling the unsecured rope. In the wolf pen, the researcher ties off the rope, making it impossible to pull out. For several minutes, the wolf paces around the cage, determined to solve the problem on its own. And then it becomes agitated.
but was always though they try to solve the problem themselves, and they don't get into communicative interaction with humans just by looking at them.
When the rope is tied off with a dog, the result changes. Instead of easily getting the meat, the dog easily gives up, looking to the human for help.
So, all right, so I'll cut it off right there. He goes on to say a couple other things, but basically what we get from that is that domestic dogs are not only hardwired to read human subtle human unconscious human cues, but they also seek them out. It's just in their biology. So we have to come from that background as well. And so dogs don't need training to read human cues. They just do it innately. Now, the third kind of background thing that you need is that it's been demonstrated that drug dogs in particular are susceptible to unconscious cueing from their handlers. And so probably a lot of you have heard of this, but there was a study from UC Davis in 2011 where a researcher confirmed the Clever Hans effect. And basically, they had four clean rooms in a church. One, the experimenter didn't do anything. One, there was a taped piece of construction paper. There was a third room. There was decoy scents. In a fourth room, there was decoy scents and a red construction paper. So the handlers were told, examine or clear the rooms. So and they were told that there may be up to three target scents, like drugs or explosives, that the dogs are supposed to alert to. And they were also told that the red construction paper is going to be identify the location of a target if they see it. So there were actually no target scents, no drugs or explosive placed at all. I think I can get through in like 2 minutes here. But they had a bunch of teams, and even though there shouldn't have been any alerts because there was no drugs or explosive, they had alerts in every single room, and the most important thing was that they had more alerts at the locations with the red construction paper. So basically what that proves is that handler beliefs can influence whether and where the dog alerts, and that's kind of important where for what we're talking about. So here's the three kind of backbone pieces of information that you have to educate the judge on through experts. And Clever Hans, animals can read unconscious human cues. Dogs are experts at reading and seeking human cues, and drug dogs have been shown to their handlers have been shown to unconsciously cue their dogs as to a desired alert location. So if we think back to that, we have to tie that to the dog's training, and we have to know, so there's testing, certifications, and there's also training when the handler is going through and training the dog on a day-to-day basis. And double blind is the key. So really, double blind is the only way to ensure that you're going to have a reliable alert, but law enforcement agencies do not do double blind. They do single blind. So single blind, and I say law enforcement, both in certification and in training, I'd say that's 99% the case. Single blind is when the handler doesn't know where or if an item is placed and if a dog should alert, but the observer, for instance, the certifying officer, does know where and if something's been hidden. So that leaves the possibility that the person who hit it is going to be able to cue the dog inadvertently. And so double blind, like I said, is the only way to really know that you have a reliable alert, because it takes away the human's information. So basically what happens is both the handler and the observer evaluator, they don't know where or if something's been placed and if the dog's or if the dog's supposed to alert. So that's the only way to foreclose the possibility that the observer evaluator won't inadvertently cue as to the presence and the location. So you got to get this stuff all out through expert witnesses and know that through discovery, almost all dog certification agencies use single blind only. It's been called industry standard by some of my experts. Most handlers do only single blind at best. A lot of them don't even do single blind. And then you got to make sure to get to discovery depositions that the deployment in your particular case was set up as single blind, because obviously what's happening is the officer who seizes the money and hides it, and he's standing right there while the dog is supposedly alerting, he's the one that's capable of giving these inadvertent cues. So I had a little bit more, but I'm out of time, but thanks for your time, and see you next year. Thank you. Thank you.